talk is given by Professor Jim Crowe, Professor of Classical Archaeology and Head of Archaeology here at Edinburgh. And I have an intro which is kind of sensitive, so I'll rattle through. Professor Crowe originally studied at Birmingham University, went on to research Byzantine archaeology in Newcastle, writing a thesis on the late Roman fortifications of the Lower Danube. And he was later a research fellow at the British Institute of Archaeology at Ankara, and was subsequently director of excavations for the National Trust on Hadrian's Wall from 1982 to 1989. Mr. Crowe was appointed to the Lectures of Archaeology at Newcastle in 1990, where he taught from 1974 to Edinburgh in the summer of that year. Jim has long been involved in various societies, institutes, research and collaborations, including much work in Turkey, and also looking at archaeology in the frontier, especially closer to Hadrian's Wall. He's currently co-directing a project on the historic landscape of Naxos, supported by Martin Oakes, and a three-year transdisciplinary study combining contemporary engineering practice and archaeology, which is Engineering Water Supply of Constantinople, funded by the Liverpool Research Trust. Therefore, with a wealth of experience, including crossing boundaries of disciplines, who better to talk to us about the modern fusion of GIS and archaeology? Jim.
Thanks very much. Can we dim the lights, otherwise we're going to have a dim view. Yes, I changed the title slightly when I was putting this together, and I thought I'd have thoughts of a fellow traveller, because I still have no real proficiency in GIS, but I've been working with people who have an understanding of GIS for actually rather a long time now, since the mid-1990s at Newcastle, and I think a little before that, but I won't go in there. Even when I was working for the National Trust, I was involved with the surveying department at Newcastle, developing GIS links. So, and much of the application of the GIS within my projects has been with work in Turkey, so that's what I'm going to be talking about today. To a lesser degree, and less successfully, I think, in terms of Hadrian's Wall and some other aspects of Britain. And I think for most of you, what I'm going to be talking about is not actually very high-level GIS, but it's the applications of digital imagery and also the applications of how you can sort your data. And it may be of interest, so I hope some of these projects are of interest. So I'm going to rattle through a number of projects, essentially. What we're looking at here is the line of the Anastasian Wall, which is actually picked out by these trees. And there is one of the surviving forts, which are much smaller than, say, the forts on the Antonine Wall or Hadrian's Wall. The Anastasian Wall is a 6th century AD. It's in that junction between the Roman and the Byzantine. You can call it Byzantine, or you can call it, I prefer to call it late Roman. And this lies in forests immediately to about 60 or 70 kilometres to the west of Istanbul. And it's rarely visited and has been little studied until we started work there in the mid-1990s. So, that's the line of the wall, and the first thing I want to talk about is, well, in fact, the projects I should be mainly talking about in Turkey are concerned with the Long Wall, which goes from the Black Sea here down to the Sea of Marmara down here. Istanbul is there, shown in its Byzantine incarnation. Of course, the city of Istanbul today now occupies a much, much larger area and has a population close on to 20 million. But at the same time, this area, the archaeology is very well preserved in these forests, and the forests extend right the way across there, and we shall see some satellite images a little later. And the work in this area of this region, which is known as Thrace, has been concerned with the wall and also with the water supply line, and that's what I shall be describing in the first sort of two-thirds of what I want to talk about. Now, one of the problems we had, and when you see a couple of you, you've already seen the sort of setting in all those trees. But one of the problems we had, we could map the line of the wall, a bit scratched, but we could map it. But it was very difficult to allow people to visualise it. So we used fairly simple tools in GIS and AutoCAD. We had to digitise maps. This was produced in about 1997, so this is quite a long time ago. We digitised maps, we created terrain models, not me, but my colleague, particularly Richard Bayliss, who now works in the building sector, but did a PhD in Newcastle and was a research fellow for a long time, and we presented the line of the wall. So you've seen how the wall appears today for the modern visitor, and I was there last week with my engineers, and it looks just the same and is equally difficult to find. But so this is a way of representing, and this is a way of trying to represent detailed topographical surveys. At that time, we were just simply using interpretation. So the forest was clear, had been clear, and we were able to carry out a detailed topographical survey of that area. The real challenge is to find that. And this is an example of the sort of survey we did, and the way that the remains of the wall and also the towers along the wall could actually be so very well preserved. And that's one way of showing the data. But this is a photograph I took last week of a bit of the wall, just to demonstrate how well preserved it can be when it's not shrouded amongst the trees. And exactly the same area, we carried out a very, this was in 1998, we carried out a very detailed clearance using local villagers and woodmen, because it's the main economy is these forests where they make charcoal. And so we paid a team of woodmen to cut down the trees. And the trees are not, anybody who's sort of concerned about trees, these trees are actually harvested on a very regular pattern in order to make charcoal. So this is an entirely renewable forest, and it has been used like that for a significant amount of time. So by cutting the trees down, all you're doing is it regenerates and then is harvested. Traditional charcoal is produced, and of course this is used for all the kebabs in Istanbul. So if you have a good kebab, it comes from the forest of Thrace. So in order to try and out, this is in fact the outline of the fort. There's a gate there going to the exterior, to the west, and a gate here to the east. And these are the remains of towers. And again, this is the significance of this. This is probably common practice now, but the significance of this is when Richard Bayliss made this, and it was published shortly after that in the late 90s. This was still really quite sort of new material, new ways of representing archaeological sites. And in terms of the representation of archaeological sites to me, this is still a very effective way of doing it. And I know there are people here from the committee or from the former Royal Commission. But to my mind, this is a much more, in terms of providing access to the general public, not just to the informed archaeologists, this is actually a much more effective way of presenting an earthwork site with its stone remains than some of the more traditional archaeological means of Hashas and elsewhere. So that's a little bit about what we have done in the past in terms of the wall, and I think also the way, certainly 15, 20 years ago, we were actually going quite a long way developing ideas within archaeology. Subsequently, the project moved forward, and we didn't abandon the wall, but we were much more interested in the long-distance water supply. Now, the long-distance water supply of Constantinople is generally unrecognised by scholars working in Roman water supplies. It is actually, in its total, as you'll see, as long as all the water channels leading to the city of Rome. It was constructed in the 4th and the 5th centuries AD, and of course it was the key water supply for what was to become the greatest city in the Eastern Roman world and in the Roman world, the Mediterranean world, throughout late antiquity and the Middle Ages, which is this level down here. And this is actually, this is based on a satellite image, working with my colleagues in Istanbul Technical University. And these were, Delia Maktar, whose name is there, is the professor of remote sensing. And he proposed to us, when I was still at Newcastle, this was in 2005-06, that we should have a new project using remote sensing to try and investigate the evidence for the water supply channels within the forests. And I said, sounds a good idea to me. Okay, and he said, right, okay, I'm going to apply to the Turkish Funding Council, and he got the money, and so we had a project for 2 years in 2007-2009. In the meantime, I published a monograph with colleagues Richard Bayliss and Jonathan Bardill on mapping the water supply system. So what I'm going to show you then is what that work using remote sensing and relatively simple forms of GIS was able to achieve, and which is actually continuing to this day. To some extent, what remote sensing, certainly in the way that it was presented to me, could provide was relatively simple. It wasn't anything, it certainly wasn't rocket science. Because essentially what you have in these deep forests, you have, as we shall see, some really quite remarkable stone structures which are aqueduct bridges bringing water across valleys. But of course, what the satellite images don't provide is any sense of topography. Now, in practice, I can, from working on the ground, I'm pretty sure that that trackway through the forest actually follows the line of one of the water channels. But at the same time, since the water channels have to run effectively on just below, they're running through gravity, so they're, as it's a gravity-fed system, it's more or less running on contour lines, they actually need to turn up this value, but there's no trace from this. And this is a high-resolution Econos image. This isn't Google Earth, although Google Earth, obviously, these days is much more, it's got greater resolution than it formerly did. So, to my mind, there was this, I did try and express this to my colleagues, but they thought it was exciting. And they also used GPS to be able to track the channels. And we made a number of advantages. But this is the problem. That isn't the same bridge that I showed you in the previous slide. And yet, at the same time, this bridge doesn't really particularly well show up. And as you can see, it's standing something like 25 metres high. It's a very substantial stone bridge. We'll see another couple of examples in a minute. So what I persuaded my colleagues to do, and they still were slightly resistant to this, I said they had access to lots of different sorts of data. For instance, they had access to the Turkish military 25,000 maps, the digital maps, so they could create a sort of terrain model. So they exported the terrain model to GIS, and then they draped the satellite images, and this is what you can see. This is a different bridge, but you can see the problem, because it doesn't recognise the fact that there needs to be an aqueduct in here. So what we did was we then modified it, and so the solution, that shows you where the channel should be, and then in order to represent, because I think actually as a way of representing this quite complicated landscape, we then sort of built the bridge here. So that's just using sort of, that was done by one of my PhD students. So that's one area where we've attempted to use, I think it's quite simply, in terms of visualization aspects of GIS, combining remote sensing with simple GIS in order, certainly for me, to be able to envisage and visualize the landscapes. Now I'm going to show you two examples where we've used historic landscape characterization, what's referred to in Scotland as historic land use assessment. And this is working with my colleague Sam Turner at Newcastle University. We've carried out two areas of study, one of them in Thrace, and in fact in the southern end of the Anastasian Wall, quite deliberately because we thought that potentially, because we have this linear barrier, we might get some chronological relationship between landscape features and the known datable features of the wall. And then the second survey, which I'll come back to towards the end, was on the island of Naxos. So we had these two. So this was a project funded by the AHRC as a pilot study, utilising essentially what's been pioneered predominantly in England in terms of historic landscape characterisation and elsewhere in Europe, to see how far these could be applied in the Eastern Mediterranean. And these are just some examples of what we were able to recognise from the satellite images in the area to the west of Istanbul, near the town of Silivri. And there you can see some coaxial fields and long fields. And what was particularly interesting was that from the satellite images, it was possible to reveal different phases within the arrangement of the contemporary agricultural landscape and features beneath it. And whereas this is fairly normal for Britain and for much of Western Europe, this is probably the first time this methodology had been applied in the Eastern Mediterranean. And in fact, from the satellite images, we were able to pick up features such as there was a quite substantial Roman farmstead in this area of a field. Now, these fields are the same sort of coaxial fields that we've recognised before. We can't date these fields exactly because we haven't actually gone back to carry out either a documentary or a photographic study. But at the same time, you can see that this is a field which has undergone a significant improvement, and it opened up for modern agriculture. And yet, at the same time, we can see traces of possibly early terraces and earlier farming, which we were back earlier.
So, some of the, and this is the same area as we've just seen, and this is a more modern intrusion onto the landscape, because these are holiday homes, and if this were in colour, you'd see that these were all swimming pools. And so basically, what you see, you can begin to tease out some of the subtleties, even if we don't get a reality of the chronology. And this was the HLC analysis, which Sam Turner, this was Sam's work, not mine. We have a motorway down here, the town of Silivri is down there, and you'll notice the variation in the fields, and also at the top, the forest, because that's where the forest starts, and that's the line of the Anastasian Wall. What particularly interested me about this landscape was that, in terms of recent history, it's a landscape which has undergone very radical political changes. Because in 1922, as at the end of the First World War, the Greek and the Turkish populations were exchanged. They weren't moved from Istanbul at that time, but throughout much of what is today modern Republic of Turkey, particularly the west of Turkey, central Anatolia, and the northeast, for instance, the area around Trabzon, and also to the west of Istanbul, Thrace, there were very significant Greek-speaking Christian populations. And those who were not Greeks in terms of their nationality were transferred from what became Turkey, inhabited the Ottoman Empire, and actually became, and were sent to Greece. Many of them were sent to areas around Thessaloniki in the north. And at the same time, new populations came from the Balkans, from Bulgaria, from what is now Yugoslavia, and so on. So when we talk to these villagers, they say, quite happily, they'll say, well, we come from Bulgaria, we come from near Thessaloniki, we were very good connections and between the two towns. But what intrigued me was there had been this radical change of populations, and yet within the landscape, there was a great deal of diversity which had been maintained. And I think that's an area which we haven't actually had an opportunity to look into, which I think would certainly be worth looking into. So that's just an aspect of our landscape work and the use of a variety of... And of course, in order to create that, you utilise GIS or GIS map, we saw that derives from an analysis of the satellite images. So this is the more recent phase of the Thracian project, which Owen mentioned, which is this engineering water supply of Constantinople, which is funded by the Leverhulme Research Trust and is a collaborative project between myself in history, classics, and archaeology, and the institute we're based in the Department of Civil Engineering in the School of Engineering. And it's basically me, Jim Crow, and then Martin Crapper and Simon Smith, and Ryan Snyder, who's my research associate, and two PhD engineering PhD students whose work you'll see from Kate Ward and Francesca Ruggieri. Okay, so that's the more recent project, and it's what I think is quite, for me, is quite interesting is that from the outset I said to the engineers, to Martin and Simon, we're going to have to use GIS. And initially they said, oh, no, we've got lots of perfectly good water modelling software, we don't need that. But the research students recognised that it was important, and they've actually made some very significant advances, certainly from what I understood to be our current knowledge of understanding the city of Istanbul and also the hinterland of the city of Istanbul. This is a terrain model which we made in 1996. This was based on digitising not the best available map, but an available map which had about 5 metre contours, times twice. But it's a way of trying to... as far as I know, this was the first time this was achieved. It was trying to understand the topography of the city in terms of its hills and its valleys, and beginning to locate some of the major water features. These large blue features are systems. We're coming back to this idea of water supply. This is the Yerba Fansarai, which is the largest of the current systems, which is the Basilica system. That's the one which features in From Russia with Love. Although, you have to remember that in From Russia with Love, James Bond crosses it in a rowing boat to there, and is then underneath the Russian consulate, which is actually over. But Hollywood are always... Well, it's a bit like Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, when Robin Hood goes from the White Cliffs of Dover with one step onto Hadrian's Wall. But anyway, that's Robin Hood in topography. But in fact, this was although it looks a bit trite, was actually quite a step forward in trying to visualise the topography. Kate Ward, then, who is a indomitable engineer trained at Strathclyde, and has worked with, as an engineering, she graduated as an engineer and then worked not with British Army, but worked for an engineering company in Helmand a few years ago. Anyway, she decided after that to become a PhD student, and now she's working on this. And so I said to her, well, look, we need to find a terrain model, and we tried all sorts of sources, we couldn't find it. So in the end, she took off the best map I could find, which had, I think, 2 metre intervals, a map based from the early 1920s, which was published, and she's now created a much more detailed terrain model of Constantinople, the peninsula, the historic peninsula of Constantinople, than was formerly available. And I'm sure there was one formerly available, but it wasn't actually accessible to us, so she has to do the work. And of course, then she could do all sorts of, just to please me, she then took what is probably the nicest of the later 19th century maps. So you see this one, it says British Museum on it in the book, 1883. We scanned it in the British Museum, it's by Stolper, and it shows all the streets, and then she just draped it, and of course, she made Istanbul a bit more alpine, so she done that topography. But when you look at it in detail, it's extremely useful. Something visually, you can visually understand where roads are in places where there were roads. Now, I'm sure in terms of GIS, you could analyse this much more accurately, but as a way of trying to understand urban topography, I think that's really useful. So I'll come back to Kate's work in a minute, but I want to look outside the project where Riley Snyder is working, and also Francesca Ruggeri. Francesca's looking at how the flow systems and the catchment systems and what, trying to estimate the amount of water that was available for the city. Riley is looking at the whole processes of construction. He's working with Simon Smith. And Kate Ward is looking specifically about distribution issues seen within the city. So this is, I'm just the PI, you know, I just sort of advise them and tell them about sources and say historically this won't work. I'm really just working, this is essentially their work which I'm reporting on. Right, just trying to find it. This is the sort of evidence that we find in the countryside. These tunnels and channels through which the water was sent from springs towards the capital. And as I said before, the system started in the 4th century and then was extended very significantly in the 5th century and then was maintained with one break up until the end of the 11th, beginning of the 12th century. So a very long period of time. This is the greatest of the bridges at a place called Kurshanugeme, and this stands nearly 35 metres high. It's about 100 and I think Kate had remeasured it, or Francesca remeasured it, and reckoned it was now 140 metres wide. It's a very substantial bridge, but it still doesn't figure in the sort of standard works of Roman in terms of hydraulic engineering, which I find slightly frustrating, and I can go on about that, but I won't on this occasion here. It's actually a reflection of the way that Roman archaeologists perceive their world, and slightly old-fashioned ways of seeing the world that follows as being one of decline, when it's essentially not one of decline, it's just different. But never mind, that's Roman archaeologist's problem. This was a simple chart that Riley Snyder created to show this was the first local water supply constructed under Hadrian for the city of Byzantium, which preceded Constantinople. This was the first phase, the aqueduct of Valens, and you can see the length, kilometre lengths there. That was its extension in probably the 440s. Then a period when it was abandoned after a siege, and then its restoration, and then finally, in the very final stages of the Byzantine Empire, after 1204, this is what was left. And this is what the Ottomans then, for the new city of Istanbul, after the capture of 1453, this is what the Ottomans restored. They didn't ever attempt to restore this very long distance. And the next slide, which is also by Riley, also compares Constantinople with Rome. And you can see that Rome, we're talking about 11 aqueducts feeding in towards the city with a total length of 502 kilometres. And on this one, 501, so there's a
I mean, I think for Rome we've got fairly accurate. I mean, I think we possibly could modify that. And interestingly enough, other gravity, this is only gravity-fed aqueducts from the ancient world, the very significant one in the Bay of Naples, and then in more recent times, the modern axial aqueduct for New York from the Catskills, which is 262 kilometres, which is more or less the length of the first phase of Constantinople. So it tells us something. It has all sorts of challenges to try and understand this. I was doing a short field visit last week with my engineers, and they for the first time recognised the challenges in terms of how was this system surveyed? How did they engineer it? And that's what hopefully at the end of the project in another year and a half we'll have got through. One of Reiner's interests really is particularly the whole process of construction. His PhD was based on the analysis of the mortar materials. The mortars, in other, but of course the mortars that we used weren't just ordinary mortars you'd buy in the shop. They were a combination of broken tiles in very large quantities of lime mortars, which is burnt lime, and also sand. And where did all that material come from? Plus the building stone, which was used for the channels and also for the bridges. And so these are some of the rather sort of stunning, the structural stone that was needed in terms of quantities and heights, in comparison with the pyramids. And he's used a variety of contemporary large liquid containers in order to try and give people an idea of the quantities required. This is for water. He did quite like super tankers for a while, but he's gone back to Olympic swimming pools. And so the total, the estimate is the total number of Olympic swimming pools required would be 456. And of course, from those basic estimates, we can then have these sort of questions, workforces, mandates, and so forth. And the way the project is developing is he's now applying agent-based modelling to try, which is working with Simon Smith, who works on process engineering and contemporary projects and how large contemporary projects are organised. So Simon and Ryan are both working together to try and think about workforces, the organisation of construction, the organisation of the process of construction, and so on. And as far as I know, this sort of study has never been carried out for the ancient world before, so it'll be a very instructive result. If we come back, now, if we move from the countryside back into the city, this was the I think, a very elegant, very fine piece of cartography produced by Richard Davis for the book that we published in 2008. And it shows basically the topography of the city, which we've already seen, but it also shows the projected line of water supply lines, one over here and one there, and a yellow one and a blue one. In fact, I'll show you another example of that in a minute, which actually I think is a bit more probably. Now, what Kate is really concerned with, as a hydraulic engineer, what she's concerned is trying to model demand and water distribution. And so that's the first thing. And so this is her basic plan. We have inflow, we have network, and we have users. And what she wants to try and work out is how far the very large number of systems, which are known from the system, the city, there are over 200 cisterns of Byzantine date known from the modern city of Istanbul, the old peninsula of Istanbul, and how we can understand that network, which in turn gives us a greater insight onto the users and other aspects of the city. And this is the latest plan that she's used based on the terrain model that I mentioned before, and she's here modelling the lines of two different water channels, one of which came from a closer source, which was essentially the old Roman system, which I showed you, which comes from the area of the forest of Belgrade, which was later used by the Ottomans, and enters the city at an elevation of about 35 metres above sea level. And the higher level system, which comes from forests, and was that very long water channel, which is coming, way out into the countryside, and that enters the city at approximately at an elevation of 62 metres. And
it needs to be at that elevation in order to supply a whole sequence of known systems and also to supply the city as it expanded. And this is a possibility of how water was got. There's another big system over here, and how that one was. So we have known places, we can hypothesise, or we have up till recently hypothesised where the channel was, and what Kate's now doing is looking at it with much greater granularity in terms of understanding how the whole thing would have worked together. This long straight line is actually a long aqueduct bridge right in the middle of the city, but I'm not going to talk about that. Now, from a number of archival evidence, mainly now in the German Archaeological Institute in Istanbul, and also surviving in museums in Istanbul, we know that there were channels located of Byzantine date. These are large stone water channels. So there's a series of closed channels, as you can see there. And elsewhere, we can also see channels like this. And there are lots of them. These are the sort of stone channels we've seen. And so what Kate's been doing, for the first time, nobody's actually really... She's taken the evidence, and she's now very careful, with the time that her PhD research allows her, is locate this topographically within the GIS. And here you can see this is where these were located. Nobody's done that until now. So I think that's a really important process. And she's now been able to produce this. This is part of the map that you saw earlier. This is the highest area of the city. This is towards the eastern end. The older part of Byzantium was located here. The new city of Constantine, founded in 330, was extended out to the west. The Golden Horn is to the north, the Sea of Marmara is to the south. And then these are the channels. We know it crosses this bridge. We know there are channels down here, so we're beginning to link up points all the way along. So I think this is really exciting, the way that she's beginning to be able to document this. And she's also being able to question which bits could be... I mean, we've assumed lots of things about which areas in terms of elevation could be supplied with water from one pipeline being cleaned to another. She's now beginning to challenge this, and in particular, there's a set of bars which are known from excavation, which are known from text, which are also known from excavations, which seem to be outside of the supply line from the 4th century, and yet we know from historical sources that they've supplied. So it's creating a really interesting... as I say, the actual GIS level is relatively simple. It's elevations and what can be... It's basically flooding, is what hydraulic engineers do. What you can flood an area, what you can't flood. But at the same time, it's enabling us to getting insights into the networks. And this is her latest attempt to create a network analysis of all the known water features. So, there is one final bit that I must mention, because I find it very interesting in terms of spatial analysis. It's surprising, I mean, for the city of Rome, it's also partly true, how little hard information we have. We have lots of anecdotal information for ancient cities, but we've got very little hard information. And there's one text which dates from the 420s AD, which is called the Notitia Urbis, which represents the major regions of the city, and it represents a whole sequence of the attributes of those regions, including public bakeries and private bakeries, private bars, public bars, and so on. And again, in terms of mapping, she's made some very significant advances, and from that is beginning to be able to model population distribution. So I'd be very interested in other people working on population distribution, but based on very limited data. And I think this is, again, it's a really very interesting development in what she's been able to achieve. So that's what we've been doing, and I think in terms of the GIS, and particularly the last year and a half with the engineering project, I think now that we've actually got the basic data on which to base our GIS, the GIS can actually create some significant contributions. So finally, I want to look at Naxos, which is an island in the Cyclades. I'm sure you all know. It's the largest of the Cyclades. It's much bigger, say, than Mykonos or some of the other islands nearby. It's a very fertile island. It's particularly well known for growing potatoes. Not many of you, I'm sure you know, but it's also significant because it has a very large number of Byzantine churches. And in, I think it was probably about 2005, Sam Turner, who's a medieval archaeologist and has worked with historic landscape characterisation at Newcastle, when I was at Newcastle, said, what would be a good place where we could try out HLC in the Eastern Mediterranean, where we've got some good comparative data? And I said, well, one of them might well be Thrace, and I've shown you an example of that. Although, I think in the interest, the results need to be tested. And the second one, I said, well, why not Naxos? Because Naxos has several churches. And this was, I've been there on holiday, but I haven't really looked at the other. Surely there might well be some relationship between the field patterns that we recognise with this pattern of churches. And what's particularly important is, as you can see from the top left, there are lots of churches which date before the 10th century AD, a very significant number, the red ones, before the 13th century, and a lesser number which date before the 16th century. And this is quite different from other islands like Crete and other parts of Greece, where we have middle, you know, in other words, 10th, 11th, up to 14th, 15th century buildings. But Naxos is one of the very few areas where we have this early survival of buildings, which can be dated from a variety of sources, but particularly from the wall paintings, such as that. So, on the basis of that evidence, we said, okay, oh, I'll just say, this is an example of the very unusual wall paintings you get in Naxos. This is actually from the apse of a church, where you might expect to find Christ and the Apostles. Instead, you find a rather large hen and her chicks. So it's a very, very interesting and iconic imagery. There's an attempt to, and this can be dated to the, it must date from something like the 8th or 9th century. Okay. At the same time, a Norwegian project had started on Naxos from the University of Oslo, Professor Knut Ødegaard, and they were interested in a Byzantine fortress, which was probably, of an early medieval day. And you'll notice that our focus is very much to this period after the end of the classical world, after 600, up to the middle high Middle Ages. In fact, in 1207, the island was captured by the Venetians. So we're interested in that early period, because, of course, that's a period when we have very little in the way of historical evidence. And it's, in terms of the known archaeological evidence, it's much less well understood. So the Norwegians were focusing on this site, and eventually we got a permit from the Greek Ministry of Culture to work with the Norwegians, and we're working on the landscapes around it. And the examples I'm going to show you are not from this area, although that's where the project has been working for the last 2 years, and where we did survey work last year. And that's this extraordinary rocky hill. This is 500 metres high. And yet on top of it is a documentable small town. And that's the village which we've been able to trace beneath it. Right, okay. More importantly, it's the association of these early churches with these monuments. And what we really, the work that I'm doing with my colleagues in Newcastle is really to try and to understand the landscapes which are contemporary, both with the Castro, the fortress, and also these early churches in that sort of way. Now, in fact, the results are best documented, and we've also carried out also laser scanning of these churches. That's the interior of one of the churches. And that's the sort of very unusual decoration that you find in the churches. Now, what I want to rather is concern myself with this area here. This is upon a Castro, the Padua Castro, where I was brought from, is down here. Up in here, which is where these three papers that we published between 2009 and 2011, which look at the application of historic landscape characterization. Now, this is the area to the north of Apalio de Castro, and here you can see this is an area of olive groves and oak trees and quite intensive cultivation. And within it, you can find a whole range of early medieval churches. This one, because Azilaros and the Taxiarchus there, and a large settlement of Chalkia here. Now, the historic, this is the analysis which Sam was able to complete as part of that project. And here you can see a combination of terraces, field boundaries, tracks, and streams. Slightly different, or quite different from the one that we found at Silivri, which represented a much more changed and to a large degree contemporary landscape. This, I think we could argue, is a much older landscape, essentially. And I haven't got a slide to demonstrate it, but one of the sources we've used is the collection of RAF photographs, which are now held by Historic Environment Scotland in the Old Royal Commission offices, that very large aerial reconnaissance archive. And those photographs demonstrate quite clearly that the terrace pattern is essentially the same that we can see in 1943 when we can compare it with a contemporary pattern on the villages. So there's not been a radical change since the middle of the 20th century. And through that, we're able to then extrapolate backwards to say that this is essentially quite an old landscape of terraces, and then begin to sort of tease questions like, you know, how do the churches relate to the terraces and so forth, and so far, and so enable us to gain a greater understanding. Now, that's that first pattern. We've seen the air photograph is from the north, looking down from that church to this church. The previous slide showed you the careful mapping of the terraces and the field boundaries. And then this is the historic landscape characterization, which is based on that map, and demonstrates the variety between one type of land use and another. And what is particularly striking, and this is just one example, and as I say, this was a pilot project which we hope to extend over the next few years, it's the way that these churches are so clearly situated on the transitional zone between the more intensely occupied areas with the olive groves and the oak forests and the sort of rough pasture areas over to the northwest. And you could argue, well, you could see that from an air photograph, which you could. But I think by concentrating on the landscape in this way, it reveals some, as I say, greater granularity, if you like. And hopefully the project over the next few years will be able to demonstrate these components. So those are really the major case studies I wanted to talk about. The applications initially in terms of visualization in Thrace, then the applications in terms of the water supply system. The water supply system, I think potentially this collaboration, this sort of transdisciplinary collaboration with engineering, I think will have great fruits in terms of much greater understanding, much broader understanding, both for the archaeologist, the historian, and hopefully for the engineers as well. I'm not sure what the engineers get out of it, apart from truth, it's really Istanbul, but they seem to be very interested in this, seem to be quite happy doing it. And then in terms of the historic landscape characterization, the application both to parts of Thrace, where we need to go back and we need to think about the more recent historical landscapes and also the contemporary land use of why these patterns are so different in adjacent areas in terms of landholdings and so on. And then in terms of Naxos, where we have a known activity in terms of the minor monumental architecture, such as this small church here, all of which draw us back into landscapes of the early medieval period, including, of course, ancient trees and ancient field walls and road systems, but also draw us back into different aspects of land use, and at the same time, elements of landscapes in terms of ritual landscapes, which is, of course, what many archaeologists find very fascinating, although when I actually look at the study of ritual landscapes, frequently come away slightly dissatisfied. I attended a 3-day workshop in Dublin earlier this year based on Cyprus, and I wasn't quite sure what the ritual landscapes really meant, apart from the distribution of what they claim to be religious sites. Here, I think we have the opportunity to look at the ritual landscapes through historical landscape characterization and situate the churches, try to engage with the settlements, and then finally, what I think is a this is for a new book by James Rebanks, and I think it's become very popular. I'm not sure I agree with all of it, but it does embody what I think needs to be recognised in studying landscape, and what both the approaches in Constantinople in terms of not just thinking about the chronology of the building, but how, what were the energies that were required. And those energies are not simply from the state, those energies are from the individual. So when Rebanks talked about landscapes are created by the efforts of nobodies, he means people who are just not documented. And then he goes on to say it should be the history of nobodies. And I think there's nothing wrong for the archaeologists to study the history of the nobodies.
Thank you.
See what I'm doing now. It's quite difficult, you know. Can I suggest that you do get one of those pointers in the back?
Yeah.
Whoever took it should bring it back.
Someone's done my jigs as well. Questions?
Was that me?
Oh, yes.
Question about the water systems that you've documented.
Yeah.
Given that it's probably the government was running the projects at the time, I would assume there must be some documentary evidence about payments being made or organisation of bands of people who are working together. Nothing at all.
Well, there are laws. There are a series of law codes in the 5th century, and there are a series of law codes in the 6th century. And from those you can extract a certain amount of information. And we've extracted everything we could possibly do before we started this project. So there is a little more about. There's one interesting text in the 8th century, which is in some sense called the Dark Age, from a chronicler who normally doesn't buy any real information at all. And suddenly he tells us how many men were required to restore the aqueducts. The problem is you don't know whether these are generic figures or actual figures. But they, I mean, it's an indication that when the aqueducts were restored, it was a very major, undertaking. But whether you can actually see these as actual figures, they would be very garbled by the time they got to the point. But the sort of documentary evidence that you find in, say, England in particular, for the castles of Edward I, that sort of documentary evidence is absolutely lacking in the downtown world. Which is why.
In general, rather than specifically for these.
Oh, yeah. You do, much later, you get documentary evidence which can be associated with monastic institutions, where you have the survival of monastic archives. So around Mount Athos or something. So you might have documentary evidence, but otherwise it's sort of documentary evidence that you hope for doesn't exist.
Do we assume that it must have existed, but it doesn't survive?
Oh, they were intensely bureaucratic states.
Yeah,
it's just
all wrong. There must be something, I don't know.
Yeah, I think from the outside it would be quite surprising for the history of it. Which is why these approaches are necessary.
Jim, thank you for that. I thought it was absolutely fascinating talk that wove together archaeology, geography, GIS, history into a wonderful tale. I'm going to continue with the data theme but move into sort of GIS data.
Yeah.
In Scotland we're getting very used to the wonderful work that Chris Fleet's done, particularly in terms of digitising massive numbers of map series through time, and we've actually got quite a richness of historical map data.
Yes.
Can you contrast that for us with the situation you found in Turkey, where presumably with the sort of more, the military are not terribly keen on letting other strategically important documents out of the world?
Well, that has been a problem, but as I mentioned, working with Derya Maktar, who has very good connections with the Turkish military. He lectures to the Air Force Staff College, so that does help on remote sensing. But the situation initially, it was desperate, and we relied on photocopies of the quite legally photographs which we got from Istanbul Technical University from the geology department of Turkish military maps, which were 1 to 25,000. So that first digitization of the landscape was based on some poor
postgraduate student digitizing a photocopy of a 25,000 map. But it produced, you know, a landscape. That was the first time anybody had done that. And then subsequently, we did some archival work in the British Library, and we discovered that the dear old British Army, at some point in the early part of the Second World War, had recreated what were clearly Ottoman 25,000 maps. And the Ottoman 25,000 maps, and I haven't really gone into these in huge detail, were, I think, created after the Balkan War in 1912-1913, probably with the aid of either the Germans or the Austrians. And they are pretty high quality contour maps, 25,000. And for the first phase of the project, for the publication of the book, which we did in 2008, we actually used those British Army versions of the Ottoman maps as our map base, and we found them pretty reliable. So that's the best map base we've ever found. And then there are subsequent Turkish maps, but there's nothing it's as good as that until you get to the more recent ones, and then they're more difficult to use because they are military maps. And until recently, they were very difficult to access. So they have on the top of them, they have top secret. But everybody ignores that now, as far as I can see. You don't know, the government's changed, they might go back to top secret. But they are basically say, history, you see, which is, oops, land in jail, if I take that out of the country. So you do have certain problems. And similarly, when getting the digital 25,000 map, which I was able to use with research students in Istanbul, they were very reluctant to use to take that data out of the country. So that's why 4K helps it.
You alluded to, talking about modern maps, but the fact that laying out water over such a length is actually indicative of a pretty major feat in surveying, because let's face it, if they got the house wrong, project, you've no idea of how they did it.
Well, we know the basic principles that the Romans applied, and that's what various people have worked that out for a long time. And we can only assume that they simply did it through trial and error over very long distances. But we were reflecting on this last week when we were back there looking, and I showed these tunnels to the engineers. They hadn't actually seen them before. And they were just astonished. In the same way that when I explained Moosley, everybody else is astonished that it is feasible to lay these systems out over such long distances. And it's quite clear. I mean, Versailles, as far as we can tell, is probably a forested landscape in antiquity, although a different sort of forest, because it wasn't managed in the same way as it is today. Sure, that management is, I think, quite recent. It's within the last 17 years. But you first of all have to fell the forest, you have to fell, you know, swathes through the forest where you think your water channels are going to get. And then you have to lay your water lines, and then you have to siphon. It's very complex.
Yeah, yeah.
Without modern surveying, which is an extremely challenging task.
Yeah, you're lacking the spirit level.
Well, they did have these sort of water levels on there.
Yeah, it's a short base.
But it's, yes, we need a sense of ratio of both. I'm very interested in the construction. I haven't gone into it, but I've always been intrigued by the extensive construction canals, particularly in the 17th century, because they obviously had exactly the same difficulties. Sort of looking into some kind of canal.
If you're doing a straight line, then you can rely on the visuals.
Yes, you can.
To do it round the contour.
I didn't show you very many photographs of how irregular that landscape is, but it's extremely irregular.
Is there any evidence of mistakes that they might make?
Well, I think there is. There's one tunnel that we weren't the first people to attempt to map system. There's a professor of hydroengineering from Istanbul Technical University from Chechen, who did it a few years before us, but the problems with this, I mean, it was a very important initial study. But he documented, in fact, one of these tunnels way below all the others. I cannot help but feel that somebody got it completely wrong. It was a super cock up, and they said, well, it's not going to work, mate. And we did find it, and I'd love to go back and actually properly, I think we didn't properly survey it, and I'd love to be able to document. I mean, what's interesting about the project is the way that technology, I mean, since I've been working there for 20 years this way, so started in 94, and it's now, that's 20 years ago, the technology has changed so rapidly that
within about a couple of years, we started to use differential GPS, but it was very, it was really quite complicated. And then subsequently, we used GPS, particularly the issue team, and then we're now thinking about going back and redoing some of that again. So, but it is, you know, what was very difficult initially has become much simpler. And it's similarly, I was able to trace the line of the Anastasian Wall about 4 or 5 years ago on a satellite image to get a pretty precise line, which we had to map by going through forests and cutting trees down. So things within that 2 decades, things changed quite very radically.
Well, a question from Jim from a physical geography point of view, and some loose thoughts from an urban geography point of view, where I'm on slightly less shaky ground, right? If you've got information on the streams and all what water sources that fed this aquifer, is there any, now of course there's been climate change, right? But is there any chance you could estimate the amount of water it was transporting to the city?
Yeah.
And if you could estimate then how much water people needed, that might give you some figures on population size.
Well, that's a very good question, and it's one that we are looking at, because the other scholar, Francesca Ruggiero, she's not quite as well advanced, certainly in terms of her graphics as well as Kate. She's looking precisely at those issues, and we're currently trying to get rainfall data. When she was in Central last week, she's finally got somebody who's going to give her contemporary rainfall data. And the engineers reckon that if they have contemporary rainfall data in the geology, they can give the potential of the springs, the major springs, and we know where the major springs are, so we can give the potential of the major spring, so we can give a potential delivery of water towards the city. So it goes some way to answering that question. And what I'm particularly interested in is if we know the potential with the contemporary rainfall data, and I don't know how far, you know, what the range of that historical data is for that part of Turkey, but it's presumably at least 50 years. It would be very interesting then to model that and then put in some, because historians, particularly climate historians, have been, as you know, they've been really active, they've been speculating wildly. And I look at some of them, what they suggest, and I think, oh, why is that? It'd be quite interesting to model a whole range of scenarios based on the contemporary rainfall data and the potential delivery, and then thinking about dry spells and cold spells and so forth. And what impact that would have on the city is something we're going to do.
If I could give my some big thoughts from an urban geography
perspective,
right? I was very interested, this may not be terribly important within the context of your work. You did show a map on the distribution of, an estimate of the distribution of population.
Yes.
Right. Now, I wonder if you could perhaps, if it was going to be useful to improve the map estimate, two things. You could maybe, if you had a little bit of information in the city and its land use, you could use perhaps asymmetric mapping methods. We have an expert in that in the room, but I won't name him. You could to decide where, you know, to rule out certain areas.
Yeah.
Okay. And that might refine the idea of the population.
Yeah.
Then, I wonder if ideas on urban spatial structure might be of some use. I mean, there's quite a literature on pre-industrial cities and their spatial structures, you know, in terms of social class and possibly density. I would look to that. I'm very up to date on that literature, but it's very interesting. And I wonder if you wanted to refine your idea of the spatial structure of the city, including mainly population, but other things, whether that literature it might be useful to you.
Quite possibly. I mean, the problem with Constantinople as a city is that it's been too successful insofar that it was the capital of an empire until 1453, and then it became the capital of the Ottoman Empire. So it's just built on, which is why you don't have the survival of the ancient archaeology as you do in Pompeii. But even in Rome, we know a huge amount more about the topography of the ancient city of Rome in terms of understanding the density of housing and so forth. Whereas when it comes to Constantinople, we know virtually nothing. We had still hardly one excavated Byzantine house. Virtually, we've got a few palaces, but we've got no house. So, analogy, proxy, is I think probably the best way to go forward. And so the sort of things you suggest, absolutely right. And some of the, and I only showed one or two of the, one or two examples of what cases we're doing, the postgraduate students have been doing, which is very active at trying to find all sorts of different ways to represent her data. And so it's precisely these ideas about spatial living. One of them, for instance, is according to slope. Because as you've seen from the topographical models, some parts of the city are very steep and other parts are not so steep. And therefore you can expect greater levels of population on flatness and carrying very steep things, etc. Yeah. So there are a whole range of possibilities, yeah, but thank you. But you mentioned an analysis which was not familiar to me, but somebody sitting in the room who has remained silent. Right, I mean, I know, but carry on.
What's the question? A stupid question.
Yeah.
When I was in Granada in El Hombre, I was told that water was a status symbol to them, so that's why they had so many water features in their houses. Yeah. So I was wondering if you could use the water distribution to see where areas were more socioeconomically adept than others.
Well, this is certainly one. I mean, the maps, the various maps, and I didn't show you the full range of this because there wasn't time to all that sort of thing. It's very interesting to contrast in this document called the Notitia Augusta, which is the only document in the sense which we have from the 15th century, which contrasts, you know, in terms of bakeries, private bars, and so forth. But interestingly enough, a comparable document, which is about 70 years earlier from Rome, actually mentions fountains, but the one from Constantinople doesn't mention public fountains, which is really frustrating. And I'm not sure why. I think it's just that they didn't feel it was very important. They obviously didn't think the water was as significant as the people in Rome did. And you were always up against them. These are literary documents as much as they're not simple bits. They're not like the A to Z. And even when you create an A to Z, you make specific decisions about what you're going to put into your A to Z. So these are not like the A to Z, they are partly literary documents, although they do actually provide us with quite a lot of evidence. But I think, hopefully, if from a study of the analysis potential distribution pattern, we can come up with some sort of questions like what you suggested, yeah.
Right,
thank you very much for the talk. It's fascinating to see the wealth of spatial information you've created. My question is, what happens to the data afterwards, for instance, for use of managing the heritage?
Who's managing the heritage? Well, the data from the HRC project is going off to York, so that's
the ADS.
That's the ADS. The data for this project, we haven't really thought about, but there is a university repository, but I suspect I was going to leave that to the engineers to deal with, because engineers have a lot more data than archaeologists have, but it will be looked up, and you're quite right. I think the key point to your question is what happens to the transmission of our data to the heritage managers in Turkey, it's quite free. And I was in a meeting last Friday with Derek Maptar, who was the professor with the Romaine Center professor, and he was saying to me, he said, you know, Jim, they still phone me up and they want to know where things are. this is because they can't, they have a copy of our book, but I do hope that one of the outputs of that, either through getting another grant it's quite peaceful getting a Jacob grant, to be able to generate something which is potentially usable for the heritage, and as I said a very brief email to Bruce, and then I'll stop here. One of the things that fascinated me last week was write a slide that downloaded, this would be familiar to you all, but for me it was quite new. He downloaded satellite images onto his iPhone, and he downloaded also somebody had created a KMZ file, which was the line based on the map that we produced, which was then georeferenced onto the images. And then he also got a GPS app, so we could actually follow around on his phone to find out where all the channels were. And it was surprisingly accurate. I was astonished how accurate. So basically, I said, why can't we produce an app like that? And then you just download, because we will produce a website for this project, and you can produce an app like that, and then find a way to find anything in these forests. Because it is, there are no really good available maps in this forest, but it is. The great thing about Turkey is they're not, I'll finish it, the great thing is they're not worried about mobile phone masts. So there isn't the anxiety of making mobile phone masts look like trees and things like that we find in the UK. There they have mobile phone masts which are probably as high as the highest of the wind turbines that we buy in Scotland. And as a consequence, you get some pretty good PRS data. Even in the deepest of forests. I think it was 15 years ago when I heard the results of a Newcastle Manchester United game, which were being texted to my colleague. In deepest forests, where you could really get lost for several days, and you could still get a good mobile phone reception. So on the basis of that, there is the potential for a really useful app to be able to find what's going on, and which would serve both as an app, as a tool for heritage managers, and also for potential visitors to the sites. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for coming as well. Thank you to my helpers for helping me set up. So, thank you once and all. I'd already say thank you to Jim. Thank you for the very interesting talk. Thank you.
Students who heard some of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry for my question.
Some data, I mean, and so the problem is that actually,